Finally for this hour, Brian Thompson's memoirs, Clever Girl, A Sentimental Education, the follow-up to his almost Costa-winning book, Keeping Mum. In part three, Brian's national service with the King's African Rifles has him fighting a colonial war in Kenya, dubiously assisted by one Idi Amin. The reader is David Troughton.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
In 1954, Nairobi was a city hardly 50 years old. For many Europeans, with its fertile soil and healthy climate, it was a paradise. Surrey with zebras. But there was that gross imbalance of white over black. I had lived 19 years without giving colonial despotism a single thought. I was on the plane from London as a romantic, a traveller into the unknown. The subaltern's pips on my shoulder were merely the price of my flight. After taking a short course in Swahili, I was driven up country to the company headquarters. The three rifle companies were 10 miles away, each to its own ridge in the Aberdares. I was assigned to B Company, but not before being invited to the sergeant's mess, where wicked old soldiers drank and watched movies projected on a sheet strung between two trees. It was considered wonderfully funny to show two films at once. While we junior officers necked down the beer and had halves of mingled spirits pressed upon us, about 100 askaris sat trying to piece together the story. I ended the evening on my hands and knees, throwing up what seemed like every ounce of food I had ever eaten. "You're now ready for battle, sir," the signal sergeant said, ruffling my hair. "It's been a pleasure meeting you. Your company sergeant major up there will be a Wally Cooper, a fund of sound advice." In the morning, more dead than alive, I consulted the armourer and drew an M1 Garand. I asked him how much ammunition I would need.
"Put it this way, it's not Omaha Beach."
I picked the rifle up almost casually, without realising that for the next 16 months it would scarcely be out of my reach. B Company had made itself comfortable a few hundred yards from the tree line of the Aberdare Mountains. Our camp was surrounded by barbed wire and sharpened bamboo stakes. The army taste for studied eccentricity was indicated by a mud and wattle mess hut with a corrugated tin roof, where I found Major Campbell and Sergeant Major Cooper. Campbell was a collector's item, brusque, highly opinionated. Once, his kind had policed the empire, peppering the natives with insults and reserving to itself a sort of muddy omniscience. "If you can get even one of these buggers to sight and fire a rifle in the correct way, you'll have done well," he told me. Wally Cooper showed me to my tent. "See, you got the lingo off pat. The Major would sooner clean his teeth with dog shit than give it the old Swahili." It was Cooper who had supervised the construction of the camp's defences, which were elaborate enough to repel an attack measured in hundreds. "These buggers, the Mau Mau, I mean, sir, are ruthless little sods. And if they ever get among us, we'll have all on, and I mean all on." 2 days after my arrival, accompanied by a party of askaris, I went to ambush a bridge in the valley below, sliding down a precipitous path in total darkness. We lay overlooking the bridge that I could not myself see, and waited for something to happen that I could not easily imagine. About 3 in the morning, without a word of command from me, my section, some of whom had served in Burma, began firing. We put up a parachute flare, and what had been velvety nothing was suddenly revealed as a scene of wild confusion, as nearly 100 young women dropped their bundles and ran about screaming. The firing seemed to last ages, but was probably over in minutes. By the last flare, we could see that the area was deserted, save for the wicker baskets that the women had been carrying. Mercifully, we had missed every single one of the porters. I reported this to Campbell.
"Poor show," he snapped. "Utterly lacking in the killer instinct."
The women were unarmed and unaccompanied. Says you. Wait for me in the Land Rover. We drove to a palisaded village a mile or so away. The headman presented himself and listened impassively to Campbell's harangue, conducted in English. Last night, some of your young ladies attempted to go up the mountain and give food to our friends in the forest. Don't shake your head at me, you insolent bugger. You know I'm speaking the truth. The headman turned towards me, his eyes thick with a milky film. What is this child doing here? He asked in Swahili. What did he say? Campbell barked. He says he understands. The undisputed clown of our platoon was one Sergeant Edi Amin, vain, bombastic and knuckle-headed. I can claim to some small part in his future career. He asked whether I could coach him in his English exam, by which he meant, though I was too innocent to realise, could I fix the results? In front of his men, he loved to rant and threaten, but towards Europeans, he employed a wheedling tone. If you gave him an order, he would sprint off with only half the business understood.
If you want my advice, sir, Wally Cooper said, I'd always make that bugger walk in front when you're out on patrol.
S's letters came up by ration truck maybe once a week. In England, it was summer, and she was learning to play tennis. Vi had sprained her wrist. George was involved in the scout fete. My letters back were far less easy and open in tone. I was, in effect, self-censoring. There were only so many ways of rhapsodizing about a sunset or describing the moods of the forest. In Campbell's little mess, we only ever ate one thing. Curried chicken, a dish so steeped in spice it was barely edible. The meal was finished off with a second Campbell-inspired delicacy, processed cheese sent up from Nairobi in huge tins and served in wedges spread with strawberry jam. I quickly learned to follow Cooper's example, licking the jam from the cheese and masticating it hungrily to restore feeling to my mouth. Campbell, his eyes watering, would assume an easy nonchalance with the unchanging diet, spoiled only by shifting a buttock now and again to release a poisonous trumpet fart. The default image I have of patrolling in the highest reaches of the Abadare bamboo forest is of huffing and puffing about inside clouds, soaked to the skin and dizzy with exhaustion. Maybe our quarry was round the next bend, perhaps levelling a monstrous elephant rifle or a checkmate submachine gun. The first time I saw the latter was when it was fired at me the length of a suburban garden by a spectral figure with a colobus monkey skin on his head. I reflected on my short life while waiting to be cut in half, but the Mau Mau was as startled at the meeting as I was, and the bullets only chopped bamboo a foot above my head. 8 or 9 soldiers constituted a patrol. Idi Amin was far too fly to put himself forward for such unappealing duty, though I was amused to read in one of his obituaries that he must be credited with the invention and supervision of the entire patrol's strategy. I put my trust in Abassi, a surly young corporal with an unequalled sense of direction. Unfailingly, guided by senses that it seemed Europeans lacked, Abassi would lead us out of the forest within a yard of where we had walked in. On one occasion, we picked up the track of a naked foot and followed it for more than 6 hours, moving ever higher up the valley. We moved, we listened. At one point, Abassi jerked up his chin and mimed sniffing. Though I could smell nothing, the rest of the patrol exchanged glances. Half an hour later, we broke out of a bamboo thicket in front of 3 caves, 50 yards away across a shallow ravine. In front of the caves was a bonfire, and round it were stakes that held drying clothes. As we watched, a man wandered out from one of the caves, stark naked except for a battered hat. He took a few steps and then froze. What he was trying to process was that 50 yards away, I was looking at him down the barrel of a Garand rifle. It was one of the most intimate and unsettling moments of my life. Then, with a bound like an alerted deer, he turned on his heels and ran back into the cave. There began on our side a frenzy of firing. After a minute or so of madness, about 30 similarly naked men and women burst out of the cave, jerking, skipping, loosing off rounds from homemade rifles, even a bow and arrow. And then they were gone, drifting into the surrounding forest like smoke. I stood up, dazed. The bonfire crackled. The clothes hung on their poles. Otherwise, the scene was empty. There was blood on the ground in front of the caves, but no bodies. Corporal Abassi smoked a cigarette. He looked unruffled, careless even. "They move like birds," he murmured. It was all the same to him whether we had mortally wounded anyone or not, but I could see that he had registered my horror at having been put to the test. There was no judgment in his glance. He was a professional soldier. I was, however respectfully he might phrase it, a supernumerary. Not a cowardly one, but no John Wayne either. On Christmas Day 1954, I was playing football with a biscuit tin when an edge slashed my shin. 4 days later, my leg had swollen like a bolster and I was delirious. Wally Cooper drove me to a field hospital. "Don't you have any showers up there?" one of the nurses asked, disgusted, cutting me out of my clothes. "Now then, sir," Cooper whispered. "Don't get the ump. Just come at the jungle gym for a bit, and you're on a promise here. Don't hurry back." A week later, I was sent to convalesce in Mombasa. On my last day, I was taking tea on the terrace of the George V Hotel when I was picked up by a good-looking woman sailing home the next day. She told me her surname. "Do you know anyone called that?" "The Brigadier has the same name." "Well, there you are, then." We lay in whiter-than-white sheets, a well-fed plumpness next to the skin and bones that I had become in my brief career as Jungle Jim. The floor was littered with our clothes. Her half-packed suitcases yawned like hippos. Long before dark, we had called room service 5 times. We lay at either end of the bath, drinking champagne. "I suppose you're going off to university to be fearfully brainy." "I shall certainly buy a duffel coat," I promised. "Well, I shall go back to Wiltshire and learn to be a grim old bag. Hop out now and get dressed. My husband's coming down tonight to see me off." I sat up in the bath, surging the water over its edge. "Your husband? Be a dear and get someone to take the trays away and make the bed." She let me kiss her one more time and then stretched her arms above her head. "What a nice way to remember Mombasa. I think I shall steal an ashtray."
Clever Girl, A Sentimental Education by Brian Thompson, was read by David Troughton. It was abridged by Doreen Estel and produced by Amber Barnfather. Tomorrow, back from Kenya, Brian applies for a Cambridge scholarship and embarks on a romance.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
3 o'clock, Wes Butters here at the home of comedy, drama and entertainment. And it's drama for this next hour, a story from Patrick O'Brien, described by Delmore Schwartz, the most influential critic in post-war America, as a triumph and containing the riddle of existence. So we'll find out next. Then Mel is digging for dinosaurs and playing the inheritance tracks of comedian Graham Fellows in Wednesday's 4 o'clock show. So, 4Extra is celebrating what would have been Patrick O'Brien's 100th birthday last Friday. This 2002 Radio 4 adaptation of O'Brien's first novel, Testimonies, was for some strange reason missing from our sound archive. Well, now, thanks to one of our lovely listeners, we can hear a haunting tale of secret passion set in a remote Welsh valley in the 1950s.
Testimonies by Patrick O'Brien. Dramatised for radio by Colin Hayden Evans.
Mr. Pugh, I came to ask you some questions about your life in Cumbeegail and about Mrs. Bronwen Vaughan of Getley. Would you prefer to give me a written account of what happened and I will talk to the others? It would be less painful than being questioned, perhaps. There is no hurry, of course, so do not press yourself. But please remember that it should be comprehensive.
I had been a